For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the deaths of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war.
Ay me, I see the ruin of my house. The tiger now hath seized the gentle hind. Insulting tyranny begins to jut upon the innocent and aweless throne.
What is a man? Sure he made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused.
O my dear father, restoration hang thy medicine on my lips, and let this kiss repair those violent harms that my two sisters have in thy reverence made.
I am a king that find thee, and I know 'tis not the balm, the sceptre and the ball, the sword, the mace, the crown imperial, the throne he sits on, nor the pomp that beats on the high shore of the world.
This is the mighty history of the British Empire, a people living on a tiny island in the North Atlantic Ocean. Built an empire that circled the earth and brought freedom and education to languishing millions. This empire was blessed by Almighty God and one of his best educated teachers, William Shakespeare. Shakespeare has educated some of the greatest leaders of all time, such as Abraham Lincoln and Winston Churchill.
We shall never surrender.
Our troubled world needs a fresh crew of nation-building leaders. Are you ready to step up to the challenge? Welcome to the exciting classroom of Shakespeare's Royal Education with host Dennis Leap.
Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome back to Shakespeare's Royal Education. Well, I don't have any comments today, and that makes sense because we need to get into some new plays. So no comments today. You better deliver some comments next week. So anyway, I'm really happy to be back into this, and it's actually helping me get ready for next fall because I do teach a class on Shakespeare's English Kings. So this is good for me. It's also going to be good for you. Now, on our last podcast, we ended William Shakespeare's play, The Life and Death of King John. Now, I think it's important for all of us Shakespeare readers to recognize that William Shakespeare did not write a play for every king of England. He just didn't write them for everyone. Now, why? Why didn't he write one for everyone? Well, remember, and maybe you don't know this, so remember after I say it, then. Remember that he was writing during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I and her cousin, King James I. So he wrote for those two monarchs. And if you look back in history, and I'm going to recommend a history book for you here today, what I wrote here is that these were times of great concern on who will rule when a monarch dies. Now, this was especially, I think, directed for Queen Elizabeth, and also later for King James I. Remember, he was also King James of Scotland. He was her cousin, and so she never did marry, and therefore she never produced any heirs. And essentially, here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, we believe that God used Shakespeare to prepare the British to rule a globe-circling empire. And so he was a great teacher, and we know that he was really excelling in his poetry and in his writing at the same time that they were producing the King James Bible. And he had access to all of that, and in some ways, the way he would create his own words, he helped with that. He helped to even get all that done. And I'm not saying he was right there with all of the other men that were working on it, but he really was well known, and he really knew how to make words. And there's even one very famous one, a word that he made up for this play, and it's called monarchize. And if a king monarchizes, he uses his authority to do something. He can change something. He can monarchize. Because of wanting to educate the British to build this, fantastic empire, which far outshined the Roman Empire, I just wrote there, it says, so Shakespeare chose to write plays concerning the proper way to administer royal government. And he chose to tell the histories of the monarchs who ruled right and those who did it wrong. And so you have plays on both sides. And we're going to see, as we get into King Richard, here's a king that did it wrong. And it's very interesting. Now, the kings he chose were also the ancestors of Queen Elizabeth. And so she was, these are her ancestors. And so he's even got ready for Henry VIII as well. And so Elizabeth's grandfather, Henry Tudor, you know, he's going to factor into some of our plays that we're going to read as well. Now, for today's program, I want to begin discussing the play Richard II. And it is, and I didn't even give you the right title yet, and I'm going to hold that here for a minute. But the thing is let's first talk about who assumed the throne after King John died. And that's really plays actually into this play. It actually gets us ready for this play. And what I want to do is I want to use a book, a history book, and it's by David Starkey. Now, David Starkey is a great English historian, and he has a wonderful book that he put out, you know, several years ago, and it's called Crown and Country. And that's the main title, but the second title is The Kings and Queens of England. And so essentially, he does cover a lot of history, background history, that you don't get in a Shakespeare play. And I mean, sometimes when you're reading Shakespeare, it gets really frustrating because he'll go into a different scene and you don't know the history behind it. And it really can get frustrating for you. So I want to give you just a little bit of a background today. Now, again, I know that all of you are reading or preparing to read King Richard. I know I got a comment today from the JBL series, and they said, we need the list of books. We need the list of books you're going to be reading on Churchill. Now, again, if you like reading, though, and it really would expand your library if you would buy this book, and you can find a really good used copy of it. I'm using a used copy. I have a hardbound copy that I don't carry around with me. But again, it's by David Starkey, and it's Crown and Country, The Kings and Queens of England. And as the Guardian newspaper said, it's a valuable history. All right, so I'm going to read just a few things from it. King John, his son Henry III, assumed the throne of England. Now, that's who, when King John died, his son Henry III assumed the throne of England. Now, Henry was named after his grandfather, Henry II, and his mother's name was Isabel of Angoulême, and she was the second wife of King John. And so one of the things that's an important history here is Henry, this is Henry III, had three sons, and you'd want to talk to him and say, why did you do it this way? So he had three sons. And he named his first son Edward I. He named his second son Edward II. And he named his third son Edward III. but these three men are very important to the history of the British throne. And these guys were tough warriors. They were really tough guys. Now, unfortunately, his first two sons died before their youngest brother, Edward III. So in some ways, what you have now is two sons have died. Edward III is very strong. He becomes really well known. And the thing is, what you have to understand about this play, Richard II, and the reason why I'm using it, is the French and the English are still fighting each other. I mean, it's just mad dog fighting. And essentially what happens is Edward III becomes one of the strongest leaders in these fights. And then he also, he produced four sons. And it's going to lead to absolute historic tragedy for England that he brought these four sons into the world. Now, Edward produced four sons who could, if necessary, lay claim to the throne of England. That's where the problem is. And these sons were Edward the Prince of Wales, or he's also known as the Black Prince. There's Lionel, Duke of Clarence. There's John of Gaunt. And there's Edmund, Duke of York. Now, all these names come up in the play. So this, you can see I'm giving you some background so that we shouldn't be surprised where they came from. But again, their father, just did, he was really a powerful warrior in the Hundred Years' War in France. And so he really, beat up a lot of people in France. So, anyway, his son, Edward Prince of Wales, or the Black Prince, was equal to him in power. And so the thing is, the Black Prince then, he produces, sons. And again, that adds to the whole problem. And I'll show you why here as we go along. So when Edward III died, his son, Edward the Prince of Wales, also known as the Black Prince, he would be the natural heir to the throne when he died. Now Edward III died, and he died of dysentery. And but the problem is, when he died, Edward the Prince of Wales died also. And he also died of chronic dysentery while he was warring in France. Now, if you remember from when we were talking about King John, he also died of dysentery. But the monk, one of the Catholic monks, poisoned him to make sure he was really dead. And so that's what's happening. So, and again, it's all with warring in France. So then it is his son, Richard II, who was in line to assume the throne. And now Richard II had a younger brother, and that younger brother, his name was Edward of Angoulême, and he died 5 years before Richard was born. And the thing about when you talk about the monarchy in England, you got to talk about how many sons you have and who's in charge and how many, there's always the need for a son. Even I would like to do Henry VIII with everybody as well. And that was a big deal for him. He had to have a son. And then, of course, his daughter, Elizabeth, refused to get married. She never had a son. And that really threw a lot of monkey wrench into the soup, I guess. So as you actually read the title of the play, I know I've been calling it, Richard II, but when we read the play, the title of the play is actually called The Tragedy of King Richard II. And like I said just a few minutes ago, all the names that I've just read to you, like John of Gaunt, Edmund Duke of York and Lionel Duke of Clarence, and they're all going to come into play, inside this play, but then you're going to be reading about them as we go through the plays afterwards, because we're going to be into that dynasty thing, and these guys are still going to be around. So let's begin The Tragedy of King Richard, and we're going to start in Act 1, Scene 1. Then I'm going to read a little bit more to you from Starkey. So again, what you're going to be, because you probably don't know a lot of English history, I don't know a lot of English history. I have to read it all the time. And but what we're going to find out is the way that this opens is scene one, act one, scene one. The people that enter the scene, if you could think about this as you're watching a play, it says there enters King Richard, John of Gaunt, with other nobles and attendants. And so here we have it already, one of the one of the other leading sons of Edward the Third, or right on the scene there with King Richard. And remember now, King Richard is just a young boy. He's not really mature. He's young. And so his uncles naturally want to watch over him. You know, so that's what's going on. But the thing is, what's already passed is I think he became king when he was 9. And so they have to have a group of men helping him. And so by this time, he's trying to throw all that off. He's gotten older. He's in his early 20s. He's trying to throw off all the uncles, but they don't trust him. And so essentially what he does is he takes the power unto himself and essentially begins warring with his uncles. And of course, this leads to the War of the Roses. And that went on for a long time. And it was very, very bloody. So the king says, he opens up, says, "Old John of Gaunt, time-honored Lancaster, hast thou, according to thy oath and band, brought hither Henry Hereford, thy bold son, here to make good the boisterous late appeal, which then our leisure would not let us hear, against the Duke of Norfolk, Thomas Mowbray." So here the king now, he's broken his, the connection with all the men that are kind of ruling him. And he's like saying, okay, I'm in charge of you guys now. And there is a legal appeal going on between the Duke of Norfolk and Thomas Mowbray. Now is when I want to go back to Starkey again. And the thing is, I think this history is going to help you, but essentially what he's going to do is he's going to actually start another war. And so there's two things I could read here. And let me just read this one first. I'm going to start on page 234 so that you know what's going on. It says, or this is this chapter in Starkey is called The Death of a Dynasty. And so it's going to feature Richard II, Henry IV, Henry V, and Henry VI. And we're going to be reading all of those plays. So, but here's how he opens this. That on St. George's Day in 1377, two young boys stood before the altar in Windsor Castle to be invested with the Order of the Garter, the highest order of chivalry in the land. The 10-year-old Richard was heir to the throne. The 11-year-old Henry Bolingbroke was his cousin and heir to the most powerful aristocratic family in England. This ceremony marked their entrance onto the public stage. So Henry Bolingbroke is John of Gaunt's son. And so here they are. They're in front of their grandfather, and he's really excited to see they're going to be invested in the Order of the Garter. It says the future of England's monarchy seemed assured as the two boys swore never to take up arms against each other. So that's what they said. Now remember, they're from two families, two uncles. And I think everybody at the time realized there's going to be envy and jealousy. You know, it's going to happen. If one's ruling and the other one's not, it's going to be a problem. It said it was a promise that they could not keep. Instead, cousin clashed with cousin as Henry usurped Richard and made himself king as Henry IV. Now that's another unique play that you'll see this as we go through it. Is what Shakespeare is doing. He's just chartering the history, but he's doing it with plays so that people could go see it and they could learn from it. And so when I teach this class, the King's class, I have a film of all of these plays. And so you can see it acted out. And so it really makes more sense for you. It says, the usurpation, this is talking about Henry IV. And we're not going to even get into that really a whole lot in this play. So the usurpation was the worst crisis in English monarchy since the Magna Carta. So notice that this is tied all the way back with King John. and the Magna Carta. King John was not the best king, and neither was his son, Henry. And so now what England is just, it's turning over and over for a new king, but that's not a great king. And now Richard II, you know, his grandfather's dead, his dad is dead, the two top Edwards that were really great kings, they're dead. And so now Richard II is going to take over, and he's not such a good king either. He goes on to say, the usurpation was the worst crisis in the English monarchy since the Magna Carta. Over the next 100 years, there were 7 kings, and only 3 of them died in their beds. You know, so look at what's going to happen. You're going to have king fighting against king. He says, 3 were murdered, 1 was killed on the field of battle, and 3 followed Henry IV's own example in violently usurping the throne. So there's a lot of throne usurpation coming. Part of the problem was the size of the royal family. Edward III produced 5 sons who lived to manhood. 4 of them, the Black Prince, Lionel, John of Gaunt, and Edmund, would produce princely dynasties which would fight for the throne in a vicious extended family feud that lasted over 100 years. So here you had France and England in a 100 years war, and there was another 100 years just inside England. And it really is, it was a terrible civil war. And, you know, everybody out there listening, you know, America had a horrible civil war. But then there are people today that are calling for another civil war. I mean, that's just the truth. And it's not, I'm not taking sides, but I don't want a civil war. But, you know, you've got really 2 opposing sides. You've got the left and you've got the conservative right. Who should rule? That's what the big fight is right now. And that's really going on right in front of our eyes. It says, the bloody civil wars formed the background of Shakespeare's series of great history plays and their royal stars, the overweening Richard II, the heroic Henry V, the pathetic Henry VI. In these wars, the whole basis of the English monarchy was questioned and upturned, and the royal house tore itself apart in a slow and painful suicide. So again, that really brings to the foreground the way we teach Shakespeare is here at Armstrong College, Herbert Armstrong College. We teach it as Shakespeare was an educator for Britain. That's what we believe. And, you know, he was great not only at writing, he was great at presenting the history, and people could see the problems. And if you can see it, that gives you at least, you know, the first step forward on how to fix it. And, you know, that's really, really tremendous. And again, I've been teaching these plays for a long time now, and I love it. I love every bit of it. And I forget it. And then I get back to it and I say, wow, this is really exciting. I forgot this. So in 1376, Edward III was the shadow of his mighty younger self. The war against France had stalled, and the so-called Good Parliament stood up to the king, forcing the dismissal of his counselors, withholding tax, banishing his mistress, Alice Perrers. That's another problem with the kings. They had to have their mistresses, and some of them had to have their misters. And that's pretty nasty, but you're going to read about it, so I might as well mention it in a nice way. I'm not supporting it. Not by any means, but we don't have to be, let's say, openly gross. Anyway, worse still, it says Edward had slumped into a feeble-mindedness. Have you heard about any of that in America right now? Is there someone out there feeble-minded? I'm not going to mention any names. It says the result of a series of strokes, for the first time, the full force of Parliament was unleashed upon the monarchy. It was in no position to resist the storm. Edward was too ill to attend his fractious parliament, and most worrying of all, nor was his eldest son, the Black Prince. The Black Prince was the great hope for the future. He was made very much in the image of Edward III as a great warrior, already an experienced ruler, but like his father the king, he found his glory days behind him. The victories had dried up. He had declined into chronic ill health. His eldest son, another prince named Edward, had died in France. And I can tell you that name. I wrote it down later, but his son in France was also partly French. And so he died way before King Richard came along. He says, then in the summer of 1376, he too succumbed and died at age 45 in the middle of the session of the Good Parliament. In his place, his second son, his grandson, Richard, became heir to the throne. Once again, England faced the instability of a boy king. Once again, gossip had it that one of the boy's uncles would seize the crown when the time came. The most likely uncle was John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, the father of Henry Bolingbroke. This prospect was headed off by a dazzling display of royal ritual. Honors and titles were showered on the boy. He was made Earl of Chester, Duke of Cornwall, the Prince of Wales. He sat above his royal uncles at banquet and even opened Parliament on the old king's behalf. And so you can see that they were, Richard was the next heir in line. And so they had to make it look really good. And so because you were going to have a lot of people in England, if things don't go well, they're going to be upset. And, the English at that time were not afraid to revolt against the kings. Now, the investor of his grandsons, Richard and Henry Bolingbroke, as the Knights of the Garter, was one of the last acts of Edward III's life. 2 months later, the great king died. One of Richard's toys was a set of dice loaded so that he always won, and life must have been seemed just as rosy for the lad who grew up with a sense of an absolute and untrammeled right to power. So he believed he had an incredible right to the power. At his coronation, the crown of Edward the Confessor was placed on the head of the 10-year-old boy, and the greatest bishops and earls knelt at his feet to pay him homage. The Bishop of Rochester exhorted the nobility in prayer to honor and obey the boy. And well he might, for there was no rules to dictate what should happen until Richard reached maturity. And so here he is, 10 years old. He's anointed king, and he believes that he has the right to the power. Now what I want to do is I want to just go to page 241. Again, this is going to help you understand what is going on in this first scene. And it's really important that you get this. So, and again, I'm just going to read this at the very top of the page. And this is page 241. So if you buy the book, you can know where I read it from. But essentially, like I said, as soon as we enter into the play, we have King Richard, we have John of Gaunt, we have some other nobles in attendance. And what the King Richard is going to do is he's going to make a decision on how to deal with the problem between his cousin, Bolingbroke, and another duke, the Duke of Norfolk or Thomas Mowbray. So this is what Starkey has to say. He says, by 1397, and so that would be the time frame that we're looking at here right now in the play, is 1397. By 1397, Richard was strong enough to strike. One by one, the lords who had rebelled against him were either executed or exiled on trumped-up charges of treason. So I might want to mention that, is there was a revolt of the, I guess we could say the very wealthy dukes, and they owned a lot of land and property, and Richard actually started to farm England, in other words, take the money away, and that was not looked over as very well. He said, one by one, the lords who had rebelled against him were either executed or exiled or trumped up charges of treason. No one was safe. Now remember, this is a young kid. He's probably, by this time, he's out of his minority. He's probably 19, and he's executing all these lords because they're against him. He says, no one was safe. Among the victims was one of his own uncles, the Duke of Gloucester. Parliament, and that's Thomas of Gloucester. Parliament itself was surrounded by Richard's Cheshire archers in an unambiguous message that there was one sovereign in England. And that's what Richard was getting across. There's one king. That's it. Richard had regained his prerogative, which had been taken from him over a decade before, and that's talking about the committee of men that ruled with him. And he had meted out the appropriate punishment. But Richard II saved a special revenge for his cousin Henry. When Henry Bolingbroke was involved in a quarrel with another noble, Thomas Mowbray, Richard ordered that the two men fight to the death in a judicial combat. God would be on the just man's side. Richard's behavior in the affair shows him at his most malign and vain. He deliberately played up the quarrel between Henry and Mowbray, and he chose the means of settling it which showed off his own glory to the utmost. In the echo of the pageantry of the Colosseum, Richard would preside like a Roman emperor in the amphitheater as the defeated man was stripped of his armor, dragged at a horse's tail from the field, and strung up on the gallows that stood ready. And so that is the summary of the scene we're going to see now. And again, I think you would really enjoy the Starkey book. And of course, I have two. I have a hard copy, which I read at home, and then I have the other one that I show in front of the students. All right. So let's get back here now to Act 1, Scene 1. And so what you have to understand, a lot of history has gone by already, and the king is really being disrespectful to his uncle. He says, "Old John of Gaunt, you know, time-honored Lancaster." You know, it's like he's gagging himself while he's saying it. And Gaunt says, "Brought you hither Henry Hereford, thy bold son, here to make good the boisterous late appeal, which then our leisure would not let us hear against the Duke of Norfolk and Thomas Mowbray." And then Gaunt, you know, he's pretty wise man. He says, "I have my liege." I mean, he's very respectful of the office, and no matter what he thinks of him, and we'll find out what he really does think of him. But the king says, "Tell me, moreover, hast thou sounded him if he appeal the duke on ancient malice?" Or essentially what he's talking about, look, isn't this just a grudge? Doesn't your son just have a grudge against this guy? And he said, "Or worthily, as a good subject should, on some known ground of treachery in him." So the king is like, he's acting like the big judge. And he said, come on. You know, Uncle John, is this just a grudge, or is there really treachery in Thomas Mowbray? And he's coming across like he's just not only king, but he's a great judge. And now remember, Henry Bolingbroke was the heir to the most powerful aristocratic family in England. I mean, he was really wealthy, and he is due to inherit a lot of wealth. And then Gaunt says, "Then as near as I could sift him on that argument, on some apparent danger seeing him, aimed at your highness no inveterate malice." So Gaunt is saying, look, there was no malice in Mowbray to come after you. That's what he's asking. Was he coming after me? And he said, no. The king says, "Then call them to our presence." So he's trying to protect himself. They're in the Westminster Abbey you know, they're in a legal court setting here. King's on his throne. And, you know, he's saying, "Now, is there a problem with him and me? Maybe we don't want him in here." But the king says, "Then call them to our presence." So they bring them back, and he says, "Face to face and frowning brow to brow, ourselves were here. The accuser and the accused freely speak. High stomached are they both and full of ire. Enraged, deaf as the sea, hasty as fire." And so there's Bolingbroke and Mowbray enter. Now, one of the things, as an aside, I want to tell you is Shakespeare, when he records what the king says, it's always poetic. It's always in rhyme, or it's in meter. And the reason is one of the things about King Richard. He was a great poet. And that's some of the things you don't get in the play. But if you look at it historically, he loved poetry. And, you know, this is the time, remember, of the King James Bible being written. This is the time of Chaucer, you know. And so this was a really, you know, a great time for Shakespeare to be writing, you know, because, again, he was a fabulous poet. So then I'll just read this again. It says, "Then call them to our presence, face to face, and frowning brow to brow ourselves for here, the accuser and the accused freely speak. High-stomached are they both, and full of ire, enraged, deaf as the sea, hasty as fire." So there's a rhyming couplet right there. And so Shakespeare, you know, when the king speaks, it's poetry. Now Bolingbroke says, "Many years of happy days befall my gracious sovereign, my most loving liege." And so in some ways he's mimicking his father, and he's trying to be respectful. Then Mowbray says, "Each day still better others' happiness, until the heavens, envying earth's goods hap, add an immortal title to your crown." And so essentially, Mowbray is now really, really like kissing the floor for him, because he's saying that he's hoping that they add another good jewel to his crown. In other words, to make him a saint. He said, "Yes, we just need to have you, you know, you get more in your crown, and you'll be a saint." The king says, "We thank you both. Yet one but flatters us, as well appeareth by the cause you come, namely to appeal each other of high treason. Cousin of Hereford, what dost thou object against the Duke of Norfolk, Thomas Mowbray?" And so remember now that Henry Bolingbroke is only 1 year older than Richard. So if Richard's 19, he's 20. And so you know, they're... you can just feel it. Even when you see the movie, the actors do a great job. You can feel the animosity between them, you know. And I know I had a lot of cousins, and growing up, large, you know, Irish Catholic families involved, and generally we got along. And so, but sometimes there's cousin to cousin fray. So, but anyway, Bolingbroke says, "First, heaven be the record to my speech, in the devotion of a subject's love, tendering the precious safety of my prince, and free from other misbegotten hate. Come high appellate to this princely presence. Now, Thomas Mowbray, do I turn to thee, and mark my greeting well for what I speak. My body shall make good upon this earth, or my divine soul answered in heaven. Thou art a traitor and a miscreant, too good to be so and too bad to live. Since the more fair and crystal is the sky, the uglier seems the clouds that in it fly. Once more, the more to aggravate the note, with a foul traitor's name stuff I thy throat, and wish so please my sovereign ere I move, what my tongue speaks, my right-drawn sword may prove." So he's saying, "Look, I'm ready to go to fight. I'm ready to battle with you. And if this doesn't work out, I'm ready to draw my sword." So then Mowbray comes in, and in some ways, when you see the movie, there's like two kids fighting. He says, "Let not my cold words here accuse my zeal. 'Tis not the trial of a woman's war." And so he says, "Look, this isn't some woman's comment. This isn't some woman's speech." He says, "The bitter clamor of two eager tongues can arbitrate this cause betwixt us twain. The blood is hot that must be cooled for this. Yet can I not of such tame patience boast as to be hushed and not at all to say, first, the fair reverence of your highness curbs me from giving reins and spurs to my free speech, which else would post until it had returned. These terms of treason double down his throat, setting aside his high blood's royalty, and let him be no kinsman to my liege. I do defy him, and I spit at him, call him a slanderous coward and a villain, which to maintain I would allow him odds and meet him where I tied to run afoot. So he's saying, I'm ready to fight him. He wants to fight. I'm ready to fight. And so anyway, it goes on then. It'll run even to the frozen ridges of the Alps or any other ground inhabitable wherever Englishman durst set his foot. Meantime, let this defend my loyalty. By all my hopes, most falsely doth he lie. That sounds like Fanny Willis. It's a lie. Yeah, so. Then Bolingbroke goes back and says, pale trembling coward, there I throw my gage. So it's the ancient chivalry. You want to fight someone, you throw your glove down. And he says, pale trembling coward, there I throw my gage. Disclaiming here the kindred of the king, and lay aside my high blood's royalty. He's saying, look, don't even think of me as the kindred of the king. Don't worry about my high blood's royalty. You know, he said, with fear, not reverence, makes thee to accept. If guilty dread have left thee so much strength as to take up mine honor's pawn, then stoop. By that and all the rises of knighthood else, will I make good against thee arm to arm what I have spoke, or thou can worse devise. So then Mowbray steps back in. He says, I take it up, and by that sword I swear, which gently laid my knighthood on my shoulder, I'll answer thee in any fair degree, O chivalrous design of knightly trial. And when I mount, alive I may not light, if I be traitor or unjustly fight. So Mowbray says, okay, Bolingbroke, I'm ready. If you want to fight. And he picks up his gage, I'm ready. And then the king, he steps in here and he says, what does our cousin lay to Mowbray's charge? It must be great that can inherit us. So much of a thought of ill in him. And then Bolingbroke says, look what I speak, my life shall prove it true, that Mowbray has received 8,000 nobles, or those would be gold coins, in the name of lendings for your highness soldiers, the which he hath detained for lewd employments. And so he's saying, look, he stole 8,000 gold coins from you, and it's just for lewd employments. In other words, he's out prostituting, and he's using those gold coins. He says, like a false traitor and an injurious villain. Besides, I say, and will in battle prove, or here or elsewhere, to the furthest verge that ever was surveyed by English eye, that all the treasons for these 18 years come plotted and contrived in this land, fetched from false Mowbray their first head in spring. So he's saying, look, all the treasons and everything that was plotted in this land, Mowbray has been behind it all. And that's a pretty big claim there. He says, further I say, and further will maintain upon his bad life to make all this good, that he did plot the Duke of Gloucester's death. So remember now, Gloucester is one of the sons of the Black Prince. And so he's a royal prince as well. And he's saying, essentially, that Mowbray killed Uncle Thomas. That's what he's saying. He said, suggest his soon believing adversaries, and consequently, like a traitor coward, sluiced out his innocent soul through streams of blood, which blood, like sacrificing Abel's, cries, even from the tongueless caverns of the earth, to me for justice and rough chastisement, and by the glorious worth of my descent, this arm shall do it, or this life be spent. So there's Shakespeare getting in his understanding of the Bible. He said, look, this man killed my Uncle Thomas the way Cain killed Abel. Just sluiced his blood right out. The king says, how high a pitch is his resolution soars, Thomas of Norfolk? What sayest thou to this? And Mowbray say, let my sovereign turn away his face and bid his ears a little while be deaf till I have told the slander of his blood, how God and good men hate so foul a liar. So there you go. Both are calling each other liars. And the king, again, he's trying to make himself look like he's a big judge. The king says, Mowbray, impartial are our eyes and ears, where he my brother, nay, my kingdom's heir, as he is but my father's brother's son. Now by my scepter's awe I make a vow, Such neighbor nearness to our sacred blood should nothing privilege him nor partialize the unstooping firmness of my right soul. He is our subject, Mowbray, so art thou. Free speech and fearless I do thee allow. And so essentially the king is saying, I don't care if he is my cousin. You know, he doesn't have any extra privileges because he's my cousin. You know, and so he says, we may share the sacred blood, but he doesn't have any privilege over you. So what he's trying to tell Mowbray, hey, I'm going to be really just. I'm not going to make amends for my cousin. I'm not going to help him out of this. And then Mowbray says, then Bolingbroke, as low as to thy heart, through the false passage of thy throat, thou liest. Thou, the three parts of that receipt I had for Calais, dispersed I duly to his highness's soldiers. The other part reserved I by consent, for that my sovereign liege was in my debt, upon remainder of a dear account, since last I went to France to fetch his queen. And so here's a big revelation. Mowbray was helping the king, and the king needed to pay him, and he went to get his wife from France. And he says, now swallow down that lie. He says, for Gloucester's death I slew him not, but to my own disgrace, neglected my sworn duty in that case. For you, my noble lord of Lancaster, the honorable father to my foe, once that I lay in ambush for your life, a trespass that doth vex my grieved soul, but ere I last received the sacrament, I did confess it and exactly begged your grace's pardon, and I hope I had it. This is my fault. As for the rest appealed, it issues from the rancor of a villain, a recreant, and a most degenerate traitor, which in myself I boldly will defend, and interchangeably hurl down my gauge upon this overweening traitor's foot to prove myself a loyal gentleman, even in the best blood chambered in his bosom. In haste, wherefore, most heartily I pray your highness to assign our trial day. So then, he's saying, look, you know, set up the trial. I'm ready to go. King says, wrath-kindled gentlemen, be ruled by me. Let's purge this collar without letting blood. This we prescribe, though no physician. Deep malice makes too deep an incision. Forget, forgive, conclude, and be agreed. Our doctors say this is no month to bleed. Good uncle, let this end where it begun. We'll calm the Duke of Norfolk, your son. And then Gaunt says, to make a peace shall become my age. Throw down my son, the Duke of Norfolk's gage. And Norfolk, throw down his. So in other words, they're acting like they're going to try and stop them from beating each other up. And then the king says, and Norfolk throw down his. And then what you see here is that Bolingbroke does not want to throw down the gage. He wants to really see the fight through. And then John of Gaunt says, when, Harry, when? Obedience bids, I should not bid again. And he said, look, son, obey the king. That's what you need to do. And then the king says, Norfolk, throw down, we bid. There is no boot. And then Mowbray says, myself I throw, dead sovereign, as thy foot. My life thou shalt command, but not my shame. This one my duty owes, but my fair name, despite of death that lives upon my grave. To dark dishonors used thou shalt not have. I am disgraced, impeached, and baffled here. Pierced to the soul with slander's venom spear, the which to balm can cure but heart blood, which breathe this poison. And the king says, rage must be withstood. Give me his gage. Lions make leopards tame. And so the king, takes the gage from Mowbray. He says, yea, but not change his spots. Take but my shame. And I resign my gage, my dear lord. The purest treasure mortal times afford is spotless reputation. That away men are but gilded loam or painted clay. And so here's another another line talking about the importance of reputation. And I know in our class, we just finished the play Othello. And the leading character in that play is just an evil man. And he's telling everybody, reputation doesn't mean anything. Reputation is a lot. He says, men are gilded, but loam are but gilded loam or painted clay. A jewel in 10 times barred up chest is a bold spirit in a loyal breast. Mine honor is my life. Both grow in one. Take honor from me, and my life is done. Then, dear my liege, mine honor let me try, in that I live, and for that will I die. And the king says, cousin, throw up your gage. Do you begin? And Bolingbroke was back and says, O God, defend my soul from such deep sin. Shall I seem crestfallen in my father's sight, or with pale beggar fear impeach my height? Before this outrated dastard, ere my tongue shall wound my honor with such feeble wrong, or sound such so base a parley, my teeth shall tear the slavish motive of recanting fear, and spit it bleeding in his high disgrace, where shame doth harbor even Mowbray's face. So Bolingbroke is, he's still trying to defend himself, what he wants. All right, so in some ways, what we're going to read next is a key moment in the play. It's one we really need to understand. So the king says, we were not born to sue. Now, he's very mad at this point because neither one of the men want to give. Or they really are harboring some defense of themselves, like for their, for their honor and their reputation. The king says, we were not born to sue but to command. Which, since we cannot do to make you friends, be ready as your lives shall answer it. At Coventry upon St. Lambert's Day, there shall your swords and lances arbitrate the swelling difference of your settled hate. Since we cannot atone you, we shall see justice design the victor's chivalry. Lord Marshal, command our officers at arms, be ready to direct these home alarms. And so the king says, okay, you don't want to do it my way. We're going to have you go out, and we're going to let God decide who's telling the truth by whoever lives. That's essentially is what he's saying there. So this is what Starkey says about the play and Richard. He goes on to say that this is really good. It says, Richard's behavior in the affair shows him at his most malign and vain. He deliberately plays up the quarrel between Henry and Mowbray, and he chose the means of settling which showed off his own glory to the utmost. In an echo of the pageantry of the Colosseum, Richard would preside like a Roman emperor in the amphitheater as the defeated man was stripped of his armor, dragged at a horse's tail from the field, and strung upon the gallows that stood ready. But in the event, Richard behaved more like a royal conjurer than a Roman emperor, for just as the combatants were ready to charge, Richard, in a dramatic gesture, threw down his staff, stopping the fight, resuming judgment to himself. Henry the King ruled, would go into exile for 10 years, and Mowbray for life. Thus King Richard, like a demigod, struck down his remaining foes. And so he looks at both of these men as foes. Now, what we're going to do is, I read you about a future scene that we're going to see when they actually come at each other in the field. So now I want to go, we have a few more minutes here. We might as well get into Act 1, Scene 2. And this is John of Gaunt, and he's with the Duchess of Gloucester. Now, the Duchess of Gloucester was married to his brother Thomas of Woodstock, and so he's checking in on his brother's widow. And now, one of the things you have to understand that Thomas of Woodstock was murdered previously, and with the wars, and essentially, it's not brought out yet, but essentially, King Richard used Thomas Mowbray to kill him. And so that's what's really going on behind the scenes there. And so now notice John had gone. He's going to see his sister-in-law. He says, "At last, the part I had in Woodstock's blood doth more solicit me than your exclaims to stir against the butchers of his life." So again, he's with the Duchess. He said, "But since correction lies in those hands which made the fault that we cannot correct, put we our quarrel to the will of heaven, who, when they see the hours ripe on earth, will rain hot vengeance on offenders' heads." And so now the Duchess, she has her points that she wants to say to her brother-in-law. He said, "Finds brotherhood in thee no sharper spur? Hath love in thy old blood no living fire? Edward's seven sons, whereof thyself art one, were as seven vials of his sacred blood." Now Edward was really seen as a really important person in England. He's almost like given sainthood. He says, "Of seven fair branches springing from one root, some of those seven are dried by nature's course, some of those branches by the destinies cut. But Thomas, my dear lord, my life, my Gloucester, one vial full of Edward's sacred blood on one flourishing branch of his most royal root is cracked, and all the precious liquor spilt is hacked down, and his summer leaves all faded by envy's hand and murder's bloody axe. Ah, Gaunt, his blood was thine. That bed, that womb, that metal, that self-mold that fashioned thee made him a man, and though him livest and breathest, yet art thou slain in him. Thou dost consent in some large measures to thy father's death, in that thou seest thy wretched brother die, who was the model of thy father's life. Call it not patience, Gaunt, it is despair. In suffering thus my brother to be slaughtered, thou shouldst the naked pathway to thy life, teaching stern murder how to butcher thee. That which in mean men we entitle patience is pale cold, cowardice, and noble breast. What shall I say to safeguard thy own life? The best way is to avenge my Gloucester's death." And so what she's saying is, you know who's done this. You know who's killed my husband. Why don't you get out there and take care of it? And so this is like, vengeance. Take vengeance for me. And Gaunt says, God is the quarrel. For God's substitute, his deputy anointed in his sight, hath caused his death, the which, if wrongfully, let heaven revenge, for I may never lift an angry arm against his minister. So in some ways, that's very much like King David and Saul, if you look at it. A lot of people would love David to have killed Saul, but David said, "I'm not going to kill the anointed." And essentially, that is what Shakespeare is referring to. And you can see that in Romans 13:4, Romans 12:19. You don't raise your arm against God's minister. And King Richard was established in the throne. And then the Duchess says, "Where then, alas, my eye complain myself?" And God says, "To God, the widow's champion in defense." Now, that's also... it's almost a direct line of scripture from Psalm 146, verse 9. The Lord presses the strangers and he relieves, he relieves the problems of widows. And she says, "Why then I will. Farewell, old Gaunt. Thou goest to Coventry there to behold our cousin Hereford and fell Mowbray fight. Oh, sit my husband's wrongs on Hereford's spear, that it may enter butcher Mowbray's breast, or if misfortune miss the first career, be Mowbray's sins too heavy in his bosom, that they may break his foaming courser's back, and throw the rider headlong in the lists. A caitiff recreant to my cousin Hereford, farewell, old Gaunt, thy sometimes brother's wife with her companion grief must end her life." And so she has an awful, awful lot of sadness. Well, looks like that's all the time I have for today. And so we made a pretty good start into the tragedy of King Richard. And on our next program, we'll continue discussing the tragedy of Richard II. So please write me any comments you may have to comments@kpcg.fm. You can also comment at my Twitter page, and that's titled Shakespeare's Royal Education. Now, if you don't have a copy of King Richard yet, I know you'll be able to find a good used copy of King Richard at abebooks.com. And I've checked through there, and generally you can find some copies under $5. You will also be able to find a good copy of David Starkey's Crown and Country at abebooks.com. So thanks for joining me next time as we advance our royal education.
You've been listening to Shakespeare's Royal Education on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.